So our next speaker is Steve Grossley, and it's hard to introduce Steve Grossley because he's done so many things. He's such a prominent figure of the brand mapping community. And one thing that I should say about Steve is that not only is an extremely nice man and a very good friend, but he's also one of those mathematicians that, and statisticians that who care about, you know, providing software, and it's amazing, you know, the amount of effort he does in writing code and making that available for the neuroscientists. So in many aspects, you know, I think it's very remarkable. Thank you very much, Keith, for so it's a
well, what I'm going to do today is give you a software demo. I hope you don't mind. It's in MATLAB. I don't know, you have lots of people who are enthusiastic about other things there. It's actually should probably belong in last week's session rather than this week's, because it's motivated by anatomical data on cortical thickness. But later on, I'm going to show you some functional data on volumetric data. But there's some sort of underlying principles that still apply, I think, to this to what I'm going to show you, just to fMRI data as well. So I hope you don't mind me going through this this stats package. Also, it makes me kind of nervous whenever you try to give a demo. You know, I'm always afraid something will go wrong, and I couldn't resist sort of tweaking the code last night. And then about an hour before the presentation, I found something's gone wrong, and I couldn't figure out what it was. So I'm just going to cross my fingers and hope that I've got it all right for the for the presentation this time. So here it goes. So this is the this is just MATLAB script here that I'm going to run through. So there you can see the what we're trying to do. First of all, I have to give enormous thanks to my patient testers, if you like. These are the people who inspired this thing in the first place. What happened was that I was called up to the dentistry school at McGill, and there were people there who were interested in the analysis of pain data. And they'd collected some anatomical data on patients, and also measured something to do with their pain perception. And they were trying to look for correlations between pain perception and cortical thickness. And these are people; they're just neuroscientists. They're not computer nerds, if you like. And so they wanted some kind of help in the statistical analysis. And it was at that point that I realized there was perhaps a need for something like this, which could be useful for neuroscientists rather than computer types for the statistical analysis of surface data. And so what people had been using in our lab up until then was a little thing that Jason Lurch wrote, which piped the data from cortical thickness data into the R stats package, essentially doing it vertex by vertex. So why not just use that? Well, there were some limitations. First of all, there was no random field theory. False discovery rate was implemented, and I've said that there was a myth apparently in the cortical surface analysis users that random field theory doesn't apply to things like cortical surfaces. It only works for volumetric data which are sampled on a uniform lattice. That's not true. In fact, the application of random field theory to triangulated surfaces is actually in many ways a lot easier than it is for lattice volumetric data. So I wanted to implement the random field theory. Also, the R implementation was really slow. I mean, what these were essentially doing was taking the data vertex by vertex, and there are 80,000 vertex on the surface, and piping it through the R's NLLE package. And it was taking 24 hours to fit a single mixed effects model, which I find is completely unacceptable just to get your results. And what I'm going to show you here is an analysis which takes seconds rather than hours. Also, there are no graphics in R, and I did think at one point of trying to do all this business in R, but I kind of get lazy because I've got some stuff already in MATLAB, so I decided to go for MATLAB on this, so that's sort of motivation for it. Of course, there's lots of advantages for R, and it does have all the stats, but what I've tried to do is to make a sort of a stats package out of the using MATLAB, which will be truly interactive. That is, you can try models on the fly, see how they fit, get your results back within seconds. and rather than having to submit everything through Bash. And the code is pretty small as a result. It's not very big. Now, the data set I'm going to work through is the ICBM data. Everyone perhaps knows the 152 MNI Atlas. So these are the 152 subjects. And I'm only going to work with 147 because there were five subjects that couldn't successfully extract the cortical thickness. So now I'm just going to sort of, you know, run through some of the these little commands just to show you what happened. So here I'm just going to read in the first subject number 100, read in that person's thickness, and then just view it so that you can, you know, see what happens. And the viewer takes a little bit of time to come up, but I think it's done already. And now there's the answer. So you get a picture like that. I'm not particularly proud of this. This is just off-the-shelf MATLAB graphics. I didn't spend just a few lines of MATLAB code. I don't take any particular credit for this. It's, but you can quickly get a glimpse of what the data looks like. You can modify it, if you like, by changing the color map and so on. I won't go through that. But now let's start to read in the surface data. There are a list of files for these. So all of this thing does is just make up a list of files for these guys. I could work out the average surface for you, but it takes a few minutes, so I won't bother with that. I'll just read it in because I've kind of pre-computed it. So here's the average of all those 147 surfaces. This is what it looks like. Which will come up in a minute, I think. Yep, there it is. So it looks something like that. That's an average surface, just point-wise average. By the way, this the data's already pre-registered. So all the triangulation scheme is identical for all subjects, and so that's a pre-processing step that I'm not responsible for. So that does have to be all on the same triangulation scheme. Of course, you'll want to have a mask for this. So I just wrote something really stupid just to cut out the interhemispheric cut so that you can exclude that, and then this is the kind of thing that you get. So. And I also just sort of cut out this bit here where the brainstem cuts the brain there, just so that you can exclude that. So now I'm going to read in the thickness data. This is just sitting in a file which, the file names are sitting in another file, which contains a list of subjects and their gender and their age in years. And I'm going to use age and gender as two sort of covariates, if you like, to see if there's any regression of these two guys on cortical thickness. And so the first thing you might want to do then is to read these guys in, and let's just draw a histogram of the age so you can take a look. Of course, they're mostly graduate students, so you can see the age goes from mostly 20 up to 35, but there's a few older people in their 40s in the data set. So now I'm going to read in the actual data itself. This is the only bit that really takes any time because the data is in ASCII format. And so it's got to sort of take its time reading the stuff in. But you just have to do this once and then it's done. And it gains its speed by reading everything into memory. I should say that if it exceeds the memory, it'll do memory mapping. But it turns out that this cortical surface data is not so big, and you can, on my laptop here, read the whole damn thing into memory. And so there it is. Once it's in, it's in. And you know, you can look at the average thickness, for instance, where you just take the average of the thickness and put that onto the average surface, and it will give you something that looks like this, like that, and so on. So you can play around with the data quite a bit. I'll move on now just to, I'll skip over a principal components analysis. And I'll move on to the part which I think is the fun bit, which is model formulas. I don't know if any of you run across this or not, but I think most of the problems that I got with previous software from the user's point of view was trying to create the design matrix for the linear model by hand. This was the one, the questions that I usually got by email had nothing to do with random field theory or that kind of thing. That was also taken for granted. But how do I code up for an age effect which might differ between males and females and then test for that kind of thing? And it's a sort of a delicate exercise to go through and create design matrices by hand. But in the stats world, model formulas have been around for at least 40 years, and as far as I know, they've never yet come into brain imaging software. So I spent some effort trying to implement this in this package, and so I'll show you the results and how the thing actually works. So I'm just going to cut it down to the first five subjects so that you can see how it works. So there's the ages of the first five subjects, and there's the gender of the first five subjects, two females and three males. And the way you do it is you convert this into a thing called a term. And I won't explain exactly what this is, a little bit of computing here, but what it does is for the age, it just makes a little matrix like that, a column vector, and for the gender, it recognizes that there's two different strings, you know, female and male, and it makes a little indicator variable for each one of them. So it codes up a sort of a one and a zero indicator variables for the two different genders. And once you've got that, you can then start to sort of play around with them. You can actually add them together like this. And what this does is it doesn't actually add the numbers numerically, but what I've done is I've overloaded the plus operator, so it actually concatenates those columns and joins them together, so that what you end up with is a design matrix for a constant term for the age and for a female and male as two different levels of a factor. You get the idea? Does that seem okay? I mean, this is kind of standard stuff in the stats world, where everyone creates design matrices in this fashion without having to, you know, sort of go through the pain of doing it by hand. But it means you can also, you know, do a product as well, like that, where you can multiply age and gender together. And again, it's kind of overloaded the operator so that you get the interaction term between age and gender, which allows for the fact that the age effect, the atrophy effect, if you like, on cortical thickness might be different between females and males. You get the idea? So you actually never really see this little bit down here. You just see the model formula up there. I mean, you can play around with brackets as well. I mean, you could write the same thing like this, where the brackets are expanded in the usual algebraic fashion, and you get get the same thing effectively, but the columns are reordered. But the same kind of design matrix. You might want to go for a quadratic effect, for instance, like that. So you can use the power operator, and it knows that it should square the age things like that. So you can allow for a quadratic effect, maybe a cubic effect, if you like, by just, again, kind of using the brackets to do that. You can see it gets rid of redundant columns. It doesn't keep any columns that you don't actually need. And you can even remove terms as well by using the minus operator to subtract a term, take out the constant term, for instance, and drive the regression line through the origin and so on. So you can play around with quite a bit of flexibility there in the kinds of models you can create. So I think my users have found this particularly useful, this idea of making up design matrices in model formulas. Okay, so now we should get to the whole, you know, the full business. And I should say, I'd like to, at some point, to put this into the fMRI software, but I just haven't done that at the moment. It's at the moment only for this anatomical data, and I'll show you an example of some functional data a little bit later on. So here we now swing to the full data now. So I make up an age and a gender term, just like I did before, and I make up a model of just an effect for age and an effect for gender. And there's what the design matrix looks like. You know, sort of go back up to the top, there it is. It's the same one that we had, you know, the first five are the same ones we just saw, and then there's the rest of it down here for the 147 observations. And so now when you want to fit a linear model, you just provide that as a second, you have the data, the model, and then a surface, which is only used to figure out the connectivity of the vertices. It's not used for any other purpose. And it's fitted very, very quickly, as you can see. Produces some little structures there, which I won't bother going through. And so now let's move along and look at the gender effect to see if there's a difference in cortical thickness between males and females, just as a little exercise. So the way we do this is we set up a contrast now. This is another interesting thing. It's not a contrast in terms of the columns of the design matrix, which, after all, is somewhat tricky because you never quite know with the model formula where the columns are going to end up. And so we specify the column, the contrast, in terms of the observations themselves. In other words, I want to look for a difference between male and female. And here are the first five values of this contrast, if you like, minus one for the females, plus one for the males. Do you get the idea? So you make up your contrast now in terms of the observations rather than in terms of the columns of the design matrix. So that frees you from having to think about where things went to in the design matrix. So now we come to the t-statistic, which will now apply that contrast to the results of the model fitting. It's almost instantaneous. 1 second, you've got the answers. And here's an image of the t-statistic, which I just multiplied by the mask so that we don't have to look at the bit that's masked out. And there it is. So it looks like there's something going on here. We've got a value, which has been hard to read, but it's the biggest value looks like about 5 point something or other. So it looks like there's some significance there, with perhaps males having thicker cortex right here, and maybe if we flip it round, females maybe having thicker cortex right here than the males. So, oh, by the way, if you want to query this, there's a way of doing that as well, which I figured out. I think if you go like this, and you hit a spot like that, it will pop up a little dialog box. In a minute. Yeah, here it comes. It's a bit slow. And you can't read it, but it's giving you the x, y, and z coordinates, the ID number of the vertex, and the value of the t-statistic under the cursor, which is 5.15. So that you can, you can sort of query this thing if you want as you sort of flip around it. So anyway, you can do that if you like. But what we really want to do is to threshold this guy. If you just threshold it at the usual, sort of uncorrected t value of 1.64, then something's gone wrong here because it's not responding to me. Oh. What's happened here? Okay, I think I got it now. All right. Yeah, seems to have given up. Maybe I'll just get rid of this. There. Okay, maybe that's cured it. It'll come back again in a minute. So let me put up the figure again and readjust the colour limits on it. And it's going to come up smaller and I'll make it. Yeah, it always makes me nervous with these things. I try and give a live demo, and if something goes wrong, you're in big trouble. So I'll just stretch it again so that you can see it as before. Put it back over there. Okay, there it is. So that's the I'll just make it a tiny bit wider because that will make it look in better proportion than it was before. Okay, so that's the that'll come to life in a moment. It's trying to render so many darn triangles. It takes quite a while to do it. Anyway, when you threshold at 1.64, you can see that there's stuff all over the place. It's clearly not right. So to find the corrected p-values, then you can use this function called surfstatp, which will find corrected p-values. Takes a little bit of time. And to display those guys, you can just write them out at the terminal. There they are, in order. This is the usual kind of SPM-type printout of local maxima, the ID of the vertex where they were, the cluster they belong to, the p-value, and the x, y, and the z coordinates all pop out so that you can, sort of put this in your publication. And so let's get back down to the bottom again. You get the same kind of thing over here for clusters, where you'll get a list of clusters. There they are. Number of vertices, resals, and p-values for each of the clusters in the data set. But of course, what you really want is a picture of all this stuff rather than just a bunch of numbers. So that's the next one here, where you can view the p-values that you get from this. So let's just... there it is. Now, this is a little bit... I kind of spent a bit of time trying to get this right. So what we're seeing here is two kinds of p-values. P-values for local maxima, which are on the sort of red to yellow scale, and p-values for clusters, which are on the sort of blue to light blue scale. So, for instance, right here you've got significant, this is p less than 0.05, significant differences between males and females for local maxima, and embedded in a cluster whose extent is significant at the 0.05 level with a p-value which you can read off there. There are some clusters here, for instance, which are significantly extensive but don't contain any significant local maxima, and so on. So that gives you the p-value calculations. if you want false discovery rates, I won't say, I'm sure Ruth's going to say more about this, but it will also churn these out as well. It's a little bit of a modification. They're modified to allow for the fact that the data is non-isotropic, but you can get Q values, if you like, and make an image of those guys as well. Of course, you know the difference between Q values and P values is that they control different things. The sort of random field theory one, which controls the probability of ever finding a false positive, and the FDR controls the proportion of false positives amongst your discoveries. So the idea is that with FDR, you'll always report false positives, but not too many. And I feel myself that random field theory is useful for confirmation, that is when you want to publish something, because you want to make sure that all your discoveries are really there, you know, with a probability of 19 times out of 20. But I think FDR is probably more useful for exploration, where there are real costs, if you like, attributed to false discoveries in a situation where you want to make discoveries but not too many bad ones. So I feel that that's the difference sort of fundamentally between them. Anyway, let's move on to looking at age, and you'll see something kind of interesting come out of this. Here's in one line, there's the t-statistic for age. I put minus age for the contrast because it turns out we want to look for atrophy, right? We want to see where thickness decreases with age. And it seems to sort of decrease all over the place. Seems to be atrophy all in different places all over the brain. If you pick out the point where the ID where the t-statistic is biggest, you can make a little graph of what's happening at the biggest point. Oh, I should say the biggest point is actually tucked right in here, just right there. That's where you've got the most atrophy, allowing for gender, is right there. And if you can graph that on the side if you like. See, people like to see a graph of these kinds of things. So there's a picture of the effect of age removing gender for the 147 points. Make a little graph like that. Now, something rather interesting happens when you look at p-values. Here's the graph of the p-values for this one, and you'll see in a moment it looks rather different than the one for gender. There are almost no local maxima, apart from the little one that I pointed out right in here. But there are quite a few extensively significant clusters. So why is that? Well, it's because the idea is that the cluster statistics are more sensitive at picking up distributed or extensive changes in the effects, whereas the local maxima one is the random field theory one is more sensitive at picking up focal changes. So what's happening here is that the age effect is rather spread out over quite a lot of cortical surface. And so in other words, atrophy, if you like, is more of a global phenomenon than a local phenomenon. And so consequently, the cluster statistics are picking this up better than the local maxima one. For the gender one, it was a more focal one. And so the random field theory local maxima picked that one up better than the spatial extent one. So that shows you that these two ways of assessing significance are different and complementary. They're both sensitive at different kinds of things. So I won't show you the Q values. They kind of look the same. Let's move on to interaction. In other words, is the age effect the same for males and females? So again, this is how we set this all up. We want to test for an interaction between age and gender. So the way we do it is we have a model formula with 1 plus age plus gender, and then the product of age and gender. So we fit that guy like this, and it fits pretty fast. Yep, done already. And then we want to now look for the product of the age and the male effect minus the age and the female effect, to look for an interaction between gender and age. And so here's the t statistic for that, which comes up instantly, and here's the image of the t statistic, so you can look for the interaction here. And well, I'm afraid this story is not very interesting. The range here goes only from +3 to -3, which is not big enough to reach significance. I won't show you the p-values, but they don't reach significance, and neither do the q-values, actually. So if you want to look at what's happening, for instance, at that point we singled out before, there's the graph with blue line for females and red line for males. What we're testing for is a difference in slope between the males and the females, and as you can see, the slope is roughly the same at the previous point that we looked at. And there's no evidence anywhere, in fact, in the image for a difference in slope between the age and the females. So now, I was going to give you a little more of a demo of FDR to show you how you can be, you can get some false discoveries by throwing false activation into one hemisphere of the brain, but I don't think I've got time to run through that because I'm going to press on. Or maybe I've got a quick... let me just show you quickly what I mean by this. Here, what I've done is, since that interaction data is null, I've thrown some fake activation into the right hemisphere. So there you can see it, right? Just I've increased the right hemisphere values by +4, just for fun. And if you run this through the random field theory, p-value calculations, then you end up with this guy as an image, which is going to come up in a minute. And so, of course, it detects quite a bit of stuff here in the place where we threw the fake signal in, and doesn't detect it all, but it detects quite a bit of it. However, when you move to false discovery rate, you'll see that what happens is it does detect more stuff in the right hemisphere, but it also detects something in the left hemisphere that wasn't there before. You see that? There's another little bit down there. See that one there? So this is your 5% false discoveries, right? Why? Because the way FDR is constructed is that it will report 5% of its discoveries are actually false. And here they are. They've popped up in the other hemisphere. So there's a little bit of a reality check, if you like, for FDR. So, okay. Does that seem okay? Okay, so F-statistics, we'll do that as well. In a nutshell, what you do is you set up two models, a null model, an alternative model, and you compare the two with an F-statistic, and here's the kind of thing that you get. I just chose that model with age and gender and the interaction. You test the whole business and you end up with an F-statistic image that looks like that. And you can threshold this in exactly the same way with random field theory. You get clusters and the whole business. And local maxima, and you get not quite as good a picture as we had before, but of course it's an F-statistic, so it's looking at all linear combinations of age and gender, not just negative age effects, and so naturally it doesn't look quite as good. But anyway, you can use F-statistics there by just comparing nested models. Connectivity, you know, we heard something about that a little bit yesterday. That you can throw in as well. I'll just move on a little bit. The idea is that connectivity per se is of little scientific interest. It's how connectivity is modulated by, say, for instance, covariance. And so if you want to see how connectivity at that seed voxel that we had before, that's this guy here, how that is modulated by age and gender, then you can fit a model which allows for an interaction between the seed region and the previous model, age and gender. That's been fitted instantly. And then you can now look at how the connectivity differs between males and females. And the answer is, I'm afraid to say, nothing. It's there's no particularly big values in there. But you can draw a plot if you like. You can see how it changes with age. And you can do that same sort of thing with that. Multivariate data, I've thrown that in as well. That is, if you ever happen to have multivariate data at every vertex on a surface, then that can be handled as well. You replace ordinary t's by hotams, t squareds, and you replace f's by Roy's maximum root. But again, all random field theory is worked out, and I just won't have time to go through the demo of that, so I'll skip along that bit. ROIs. Emma Duoden asked me specifically to put something in for ROIs, so I did that. I'll skip that bit as well. And she asked me to put something in for transferring volumetric data to surfaces and vice versa, that is, surfaces back to volumetric data. And I'll skip that bit, because what I want to do next, which is the bit I spent a lot of time on, is mixed effects models. This is the one that took 24 hours by piping it through R. And what I want to convince you is that the mixed effects models can be fitted in seconds by this, you know, by careful programming, I guess. So I don't actually have any, well, I do have some genuine mixed effects data where we've got repeated measures on the same subject, but we've just submitted this data to Lancet like a couple of weeks ago, so I don't want to sort of show it to you right now. So I'm going to fake it by grouping together the data I just showed you, where every subject with the same age and years and the same gender, I'm going to pretend that those guys are in fact just repeated measurements on the same subject. So it's just for demonstration purposes, and I won't go through this little bit of MATLAB, but that essentially does the whole trick, is to do that, and I will not bother explaining it. But once we've done that, we can now introduce a subject factor into the analysis, and we can image the design matrix for that, and it looks something like this. I don't think I showed you this before, did I? But I put something into image the design matrix. It's a bit of a mess because you've got all the indicator variables for subjects are all squashed in here, and you've got the diagonal variance covariance matrix squashed over on this part. I won't go through the fitting of this model, but if you try to estimate age, you can, well, maybe I can do it very quickly. Here's how you estimate the age effect. You end up with a t-statistic. The most important thing I want to point to is the degrees of freedom for the age effect, which has popped up already. It's down here. So you can estimate the age effect with 111 degrees of freedom. When you try to estimate the gender effect with a fixed effect analysis, you end up with some red stuff. The contrast is not estimable. Why is that? Because if you think about it, gender is differing between subjects, between males and females, between subjects. And since I've just removed a subject effect by treating subject as a fixed effect, I can't estimate anything to do with gender, right? So it tells you that. You can't do it. You can still estimate age because age varies within subject. Oh, you know, a matter of, you know, months, but it does vary a little bit. So however, if you now move to a random effects analysis, then you can estimate both age and gender. And so here we go. So here's what it looks like. Now what I've done is I've used this little command here, random, to move the formerly the fixed effect subject to a random effect. And what this does then is it now introduces an extra term to the variance, to the model for the variances, where you've got constants for all the observations within the subjects, plus the identity matrix for the error. And so the model is now a linear combination of these guys, age and gender, for the mean, and a linear combination of these two matrices for the variance. So it goes ahead and fits all this, using REML, using Fisher scoring, and a few other little tricks. And, you know, this formally would take 24 hours, but you'll see it fits very quickly. Not quite as fast as before because it's going through an iteration, but cross your fingers, hope it gets done. Yeah, so there you go. So that was, I think, a bit of a relief for me anyway, that it actually managed to work. Now you can start to play around with the t-statistics just before. This is a lot faster. Here's the atrophy effect, the age effect, allowing for this random subject effect. And it looks a little bit like the, well, it doesn't, it looks a bit like the previous one, but there's nothing really significant there. But what I want to draw your attention to is the degrees of freedom down here. You can't see this, it's too tiny. the effective degrees of freedom is not an integer anymore, it's 54.9. In fact, something rather interesting happens, is that when you move to mixed effects, the degrees of freedom varies across the image. It's no longer constant for every vertex. And here's an image of degrees of freedom. It doesn't vary too much, it varies from 51 to 55, but its average is 54.86 down here. And I'm sort of crossing my fingers and using the average degrees of freedom in the inference in the hope that it's going to give me roughly the right answer. But it's kind of interesting that the degrees of freedom is no longer constant for mixed effects models. So anyway, we can do p-values and so on. I won't bother you with that. In fact, they don't turn out to be significant. Let's move along to gender. And here's the same calculation for gender. And I just work out the t-statistic. And again, I'll just show you what the average degrees of freedom is. It's now 25.5. So this is another interesting thing that happens with mixed effects models, is not only is the degrees of freedom different for different vertices, it's different for different contrasts in the same model. Why is that? Well, you have to think about it a bit carefully. Age is now estimated in two possible ways, estimated within subjects and between subjects. So consequently, it has quite a high degrees of freedom, namely, what did I have, 54. Gender, on the other hand, is only estimable between subjects, and there are only 35 subjects, fake subjects in my data set. So the degrees of freedom down here, 25.5, has to be less than the number of subjects. So anyway, if you want, here's a little bit of a summary of what can happen. You can choose to ignore the subject effect, you can treat it as random, or you can treat it as fixed. And you'll get different degrees of freedom for each time. Of course, when you treat it as fixed, you get no degrees of freedom for gender because gender is inestimable in the presence of a different effect for different subjects for obvious reasons. If you move to the mixed effects, yes, you can estimate it with 25 degrees of freedom. If you move to the fixed, if you ignore subject completely, which is kind of the analysis we had before, then you obviously retain all the degrees of freedom, but then you introduce biases because you've neglected to take into account the possibility that observations on the same subject could be correlated. So there you go. So that gives you a little bit of a summary of how this thing works. I've said something here, a little bit of advice here on what happens if you leave out a random effect when it should be there. You end up with biases in the variance estimates. If you add a random effect when it's not necessary, that is, you over-specify the random effects component, then inference is always unbiased, but it's less accurate because the degrees of freedom goes down. So you've got to try and strike a balance between the two. And let me see if I can show you, for instance, what happens if you start to increase the random effects part of the model. It's often common practice in mixed effects models to assume that, say, not only are the subjects random, but the age effect on each subject is also random as well. That is, some subjects atrophy at different rates than other subjects. And we should allow for that in our inference. So we can do it. You can do it by allowing for an interaction between age and a random subject effect. It turns out this particular model is not quite right. I'm not going to the technicalities, but the better one is to bracket it like this to allow for covariances. So I'm going to move along a little bit and show you what that does. And here's the results. So now we've got a more elaborate variance structure where we've got terms that allow for not only correlations within subject, but also correlations induced by the fact that the subject effect is random as well. And also is randomly correlated with the constant term. So anyway, you can go ahead and fit that. I won't go through it because this does take a little bit of time to fit. But if you go through it, you find out that the mean degrees of freedom is 12.6 for the age effect. So now you can see what's happening is that when you start to put in these more elaborate variance models, you start to lose degrees of freedom. So the rule is that you shouldn't go too far on this. Otherwise, you're going to end up with no inference at all. And of course, what else can you do in this framework? We also find guys in our lab using the Welch t-test. Has anyone heard of Welch's test or the Welch t-test? If you use SPSS or even R and you ask for a two-sample t-test, it'll give you Welch's test, I think, by default. It's a test that allows for different variances within the two different groups as well as different means. And if you particularly want to do that, you can do that within this framework as well by allowing for an interaction between, say, gender and the identity matrix will produce a variance covariance model, which looks something like this, where you've got one coefficient for all the females, and another different variance for all the males. But that is also encompassed in this general framework. So it's, I think, quite powerful as a tool. It allows you to do quite a few things. You can go ahead and fit it, and you end up with 136 degrees of freedom for the difference of genders between males and females, which is a little bit less than the 140-odd that we had before because, you know, this is the price you pay for the more flexible model. Finally, you know, you can get to really elaborate models. There's some, in principle, one should have interactions between all fixed effects and all random effects if you want to be super cautious. However, if you do that, you end up with a variance model which is huge, and you end up with almost no degrees of freedom. So I wouldn't recommend this one at all, but that's taking it to its extreme, if you like. And it leaves too little degrees of freedom to make any useful inference. So now, since this is supposed to be functional data, I now thought I would show you some functional data. So now I'm going to clear all of it and get rid of everything. And clear on that man's memory. So what am I going to do? I'm going to show you some PET data. We had a guy in our lab who came to me a couple of weeks ago and said, I got some PET data. The software we're using was written about 15 years ago. It's completely out of date. He said, what have we got that we can use for PET data? So I thought, well, maybe we can use this stuff. So I've got some PET data here. It's non-kinetic PET CBF data. It's volumetric, not surface data. And I thought at one point I ought to change the name of SurfStack to VolStack or something like that, but I don't think that kind of sounds as good as SurfStack. And besides, if you're a mathematician, a volume is a surface anyway, in a sort of, you know, higher dimensional surface, so I thought I'd keep the name SurfStack. Anyway, here's the data. What they had was, it's repeated data, repeated measures data, and I'm going to use a random effects model for it. There were 14 subjects. Correct that. There you go. There were 14 subjects with 5 scans per subject. They were given some finger tapping at different frequencies, and the last condition was a baseline condition. And here are the file names. I just read them off the directory. Cross my fingers and hope this works. This is one bit that I was trying to fix up last night, I'm going to fix this. But it'll give a picture, but it's not. I want to improve on this a little bit. But here's slice number 20, looking right through all the data, so that you can see at a glance what happens. Here are your across the top. Here are your 14 subjects, and down here are the 5 scans per subject. The first 4, if you remember, are the different frequencies of finger tapping, and this last one here is the baseline. And the first thing that you notice is that something went wrong with this guy here. Now, what you could do is either exclude that subject entirely and therefore end up with a nicely balanced design, in which case a fixed effects analysis is identical to a random effects, or you could try to save that data from that subject, omit the scan which was bad, and then recover the information on that subject through a mixed effects analysis. And that's what I want to do. And I got this working for the first time last night, so I was kind of pleased about it. And so we're going to first of all eliminate the bad scan, which is number 25. And in order to say, I ran into memory problems with volumetric data. Volumetric data is a lot bigger than surface data. And so we need, first of all, to mask this data. So I'm going to mask it using the minimum to make sure that I include all voxels where there's some data. So here's what the minimum looks like. And I wrote a viewer for the volumetric data. You probably won't like it. And it's a sort of a 3D kind of viewer like this, which you can sort of turn around and if it behaves itself and see things in three dimensions. It's kind of a bit strange. And when I get the focus on it, it'll probably look a little bit better. So anyway, what I need to do is threshold this to just sort of include all the intercerebral voxels. So I chose a threshold of around about 5,000 on this scale here, which is sort of at the boundary of the green and the yellow stuff. And if you do that, then you end up with a picture that looks like this, so that's a lot better. So I'm going to use that as a mask when I read in the data, because I want to exclude the stuff outside that mask. So now I'm going to read in all the data. And again, there's too much. If I read in every voxel, it starts to invoke memory mapping and it kind of slows everything down. So I'm going to read in every second voxel, which is what this 2 is here. And so this actually doesn't need memory mapping, and you can read the whole lot into memory in one shot. And I find that with volumetric data, it's best to do your analysis on this subsample data at a trial stage, if you like, to get a feeling for what the data's like. And then when you're satisfied with the model, you can go back and run it again with every voxel. So Jean-Baptiste is telling me I have to finish, so I'll just hurry up and do it. You have to normalize PET data. If you do so, it looks an awful lot better, as you can see from this. The normalized data looks so much nicer than the non-normalized data. Now we create... I'll just skip through all this, go through it really fast. Subject and condition factors, and there's the design matrix and the variance matrix, and you'll notice, look carefully, this subject here has got a little square there, it's a little bit smaller than this one, because that's the one with the missing scan. And then you go ahead and fit this, and now it's going to go through the fit the mixed effects model using REML, and it's done it already. And once again, you end up with a t-statistic. They were interested in the third condition compared to the baseline. So here's what it looks like as a t-statistic image. It's going to come up in a minute. Put up somewhere. I think it's going to come up. Maybe not. Oh, maybe it's in figure 2. Oh yeah, there it is. It's in that one. There. Yeah. Okay. I should have put figure 1. So there, it's a little bit yucky, but you know, yeah, everyone's got better 3D viewers than that. The mean degrees of freedom is I've worked it out there. It's 51. Why 51? It's just a little bit higher than what you'd get if you'd done a fixed effects analysis. What should I do? Let me just skip through real fast, and I'll give you the, because I've got to finish now. The p-value calculation. That's done. And let's view it so we can see. And I tried to, again, write something that would give a nice volumetric viewer, so that should have come up by now. Let me get rid of this guy. It's this one here. And let me just make this a little bit bigger so you can see it. You probably won't be too happy with this, but it's just a way of, you know, sort of getting some feeling in three dimensions of what the data looks like. And one thing that you can do with this, a little bit of fun here, is if you really like, you can overlay it with surface data. And so that's what I'm doing here. I've read in the average surface and popped it over the top. So now you've got PET data and surface data superimposed one on the other. So I think I should probably just stop there.
Great. Can I
maybe
one or two questions for Keith before a quick break?
I'm so relieved that it managed to work all the way through. So, yeah.
Are you planning to extend the model formula to include a nesting operation? Because I think that's,
yes,
that's
I know
what would
you
cover
know.
That case of the missing, the
yes.
the aliasing and the sex
I haven't bothered with that. I found that when I was using R, I never used to use that operator. I just used to code it by hand, if you see what I mean. So I suppose I could overload the slash operator to do that as well, but I haven't bothered to do it. And yeah, I know what you mean. I prefer to see all the bit. You know, I prefer to kind of do it by hand to sort of make sure I see all the bits there. And yeah.
I'm planning to extend it with something for that, so that it can be used also for first level fMRI.
Yeah, well, that's what I had down here, this little bit down here, future, you see. But that's going to be messy because of the HRF, the temporal correlation. I'm not sure how to deal with all of that. Jonathan Taylor has, I might say, written something very, very similar to this in Python, where I believe he has incorporated model formulas into the analysis of fMRI data. Is that right, Jonathan, or is he not here somewhere? Yeah. Is that right? I mean, you've got model formulas working in NiPi, is that right? Yeah, he's nodding. So I think what I've just shown is actually pretty much equivalent to what you have in NiPi, is that right? I mean, he's nodding again. So if anyone prefers to see this kind of thing in Python, there is a Python version of it. I'm a bit old-fashioned. I'm still using MATLAB, I'm sorry to say. And Jonathan, when... Not the mixed effects, all right.
Not yet.
All right, he's working on the mixed effects.
Last question, maybe?
Yeah.
Very, very impressive and tempting to use. Just a little quibble about your interpretation of the FDR. I thought that was very interesting that you call it an exploratory method. I thought, since it controls the average false positives rate among the positives, that under the null hypothesis, it would not be... definitely give you positives.
Oh, that's true. It, under the global null, it does the right thing, of course. But
so
when you do have...
Could it be interpreted as a confirmatory method?
Ruth, where's Ruth Heller? She's going to talk about this next, right? So maybe I'll let her elaborate on this because my time, I think, is running out. But it's a good debating point.
Let's not give Keith and take a 10-minute break and come back.